hour, right in the middle of audio open lines. Talk about a number of issues. Roman Catholic Church might be easing up on condom use, not for the purposes of contraception, but for the purposes of preventing the spread of AIDS and other sexually transmitted diseases. So we'll wait and see what happens with that. But what do you think? Should they hold the line on that? They have for such a long time. It's audio open lines. We will also be happy to hear from you on the issue of the Darfur peace treaty that seems to be holding, at least for the time being, and the need of the people there in the Sudan. And we heard a piece on this polygamist leader who has several compounds nationwide. He's now on the run because the FBI has put him on their top 10 list. They are looking for him. They're putting his picture up in the post office and at the grocery store. They're looking for him because he had a long, actually, it's a legacy. He does it now that his father is dead, leads a group of polygamists. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. We are coming to you live this Wednesday. It's the 10th of May. Now, Bill emailed us before the break. He asked the question, what scripture is there against contraception, at least condom use, he asks. This is probably not even counting Roman Catholics. This is probably an issue that divides Christians as much as any other issue. Is it central? I don't know how central it is, but it is an issue. Especially pro-lifers are divided on this one. Contraception. So what do you think of Bill's question? Can you think of a scripture that where you can make a case that prohibits condom use, contraception and condom use? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. issuesetc@kfuo.org. By the way, we will be talking in about 20 minutes with Wesley Smith about the life issue at the other end of life, the death with dignity movement or the right to die movement. He'll be joining us not too long from now for the last half hour. Oh, also on the life issue, even though in South Korea, remember this researcher in South Korea who claimed to have created a line or lines of human stem cells by cloning human embryos. It was turned out that most of his research was bogus and unethical. Even though he failed to do what he said he did, there are several teams around the world who are still planning to try and do it, try and get human stem cells from cloned human embryos. That's their goal. Now, to do that, they're going to need a source of human eggs, but those eggs may be hard to come by. Here's a report from National Public Radio.
Harvard University scientists plan to go forward soon with a controversial research program. They hope to make embryonic stem cells from cloned human embryos. That's what Korean scientists said they'd already done, but their research turned out to be fraudulent. The Harvard researchers believe stem cells made this way will be extremely useful in understanding and treating deadly diseases. But to make cloned human embryos, you need a supply of human eggs, lots of human eggs. And as NPR's Joe Palca reports, getting women to donate their eggs for research may prove difficult.
Just how difficult is hard to say. There hasn't been a huge research demand for human eggs to date. But the promise of embryonic stem cells may change that. Asking women to donate their eggs is nothing new in this country.
You reach a point in your life when you want to give of yourself. If you're a woman in good health around the age of 30, you can give of yourself in a way that changes your life and creates another. You can become an egg donor through IVF Florida.
Fertility clinics are constantly looking for donors, and they can offer powerful incentives.
And because egg donation at IVF Florida isn't only rewarding emotionally, compensation is $6,250 for first-time donors.
Amber Vasquez of Palm Beach County, Florida, is in many ways a typical donor.
I'm 26. I'll be 27 in August. I have three boys. Casey, my oldest, is 9. Nicholas is 7. And Sebastian is 3.
To become a donor, Vasquez says she had to fill out a mountain of health forms, go for physical and psychological screening, and make multiple trips to the clinic. Then she had to take powerful drugs to stimulate her ovaries so they'd produce a dozen or more eggs. The drugs have to be injected, and they mess with your hormones in a way that puts some women on an emotional roller coaster. Although Amber Vasquez says she didn't experience that side effect.
No, not really.
Would your husband say the same thing?
He might not agree. Maybe I was more cranky than usual, but, you know, anybody's cranky when they're getting three shots a day, so.
And finally, doctors have to retrieve the eggs surgically. Not a particularly dangerous or painful procedure, but surgery all the same. Amber Vasquez says she's willing to put up with the hassle and discomfort because she knows the pain infertility can cause.
I know that there are people that would just do anything to have a baby, and if that's something that I can help with, then I'm more than willing to do that.
But women who donate their eggs for research won't get that kind of immediate emotional reward. And then there's the question of money. Women who donate for fertility treatments get a financial reward as well. At least for now, that won't be the case for eggs donated for research. Most of the guidelines that have been drawn up for stem cell research forbid paying women for donating their eggs. The main objection seems to be that offering money might induce a woman to do something against her better judgment. There's also a concern that the lure of big money would exploit poorer women. But without money, getting eggs may be a problem.
I've been recruiting now, I've been working on the donor program for 7 years, and I can honestly tell you in the 7 years, no one has ever declined a check.
Kelly Regola works for Shady Grove Fertility Clinic in Maryland. Her job is to find women willing to become egg donors. She talks to hundreds of women a year about egg donation. I asked her whether she thought women could be persuaded to donate for free.
My own personal opinion is I think it's going to be very hard.
And it's not just the money. Regola says most egg donors can empathize with infertile women.
They feel good about giving someone a chance to have a baby. And I'm sure that the research is good for the long run, but to just donate for research, I think, would make them not as comfortable as doing it to help someone directly.
But that may not be as big a hurdle as Regola predicts. Scientists aren't the only ones persuaded that stem cells from cloned embryos may be useful in treating disease. Take Amber Vasquez, for example.
My father has diabetes. His mother has diabetes. One day I may have diabetes, or my children. And if you were to use stem cells to find a cure for diabetes, well, that would, you know, could possibly affect me personally also.
Vasquez says if scientists want her eggs, she'll donate them and never mind the check. That attitude might seem like good news for scientists seeking eggs, and in one sense it clearly is. But Alison Murdoch sees it a bit differently. Murdoch is at the University of Newcastle in England. She's been working for the last few years to make stem cells from cloned embryos, so far without success. She says she hears all the time from women who want to donate their eggs because they have a sick family member they hope can be treated with stem cells. And that worries Murdoch.
Because they are then being not coerced to do something against their better interests. They are genuinely wanting to help. But they have to be absolutely sure that they understand the risks that they take. And having medication for a month or more, having a minor operation which involves putting a needle inside them, carries risks.
Murdoch has been trying to come up with ways to get eggs without asking women to donate exclusively for research. In addition to her research hat, Murdoch also runs a fertility clinic. Women are given the drugs to produce additional eggs when they go in for in vitro fertilization to have a child. And Murdoch says her experience shows that women who can produce 12 healthy eggs are just as likely to have a baby as women who produce more.
So we ask them if we've collected 12 eggs, can we have number 13 and 14 for the research? Now, a lot of women obviously said, well, that might have been my baby, so no, we don't want to participate.
But Murdoch says some do agree, and her team has conducted experiments with eggs collected that way. Even in the best case, human eggs for research will be fairly scarce. That's prompted neuroscientist Christopher Shaw of the Institute of Psychiatry in London to take an entirely different approach to making cloned embryos. Don't use human eggs at all. Remember, to make a cloned embryo, you take the DNA from an adult human cell and put it into an egg from which most of the DNA has been removed. Shaw and his colleagues say it may be possible to use rabbit eggs instead of human eggs to make the cloned embryos.
So essentially what you're trying to do is develop a little embryo that's got most of the human genes in it and a little bit of rabbit. Remember, we're not actually making a creature. We're just taking the stem cells out at about a 200 cell stage, which is smaller than the head of a pin.
Even with that caveat, Shaw knows some people will find mixing species like this troubling. And there are scientific drawbacks to making stem cells this way as well.
These cells will still be a little bit rabbit, and they could never be used for therapy, but they can be used to study disease processes and screen for compounds that might be effective.
That may be enough for some researchers, but others would like to use cloned stem cells for therapy, and for now, that means finding human egg donors. Researchers will have to hope they can find more women like Amber Vasquez.
I've always been all for any kind of research that could help cure diseases. You know, I find that I'd pretty much be willing to do anything that didn't jeopardize you know, my health in a real major way.
Stem cell researchers have a lot of hard work ahead to justify the faith Amber Vasquez has in them. Joe Palca, NPR News.
It's just a mathematical problem at this point. It really is. There are ethical concerns. I'll talk about that in a second. But at the way this problem presents itself for those who want to clone human beings for the purposes of biomedical research, and that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about cloning human beings. Notice something. When they talked about the idea of using rabbit eggs and human DNA, that there would be a problem. They would, in the words of the researcher, these things would always be a little bit rabbit. Now, look, if using a rabbit's egg and human DNA to clone a human being that would be a little bit rabbit, just set aside the yuck factor for a minute and think about it. Why is it a little bit rabbit? We're told that these are just masses of cells. We're told that these are nothing but cells. How can a chimera, that's what they're technically called, a chimera that uses a rabbit egg and human DNA to clone human cells, mostly human cells, how can there be a problem with it being a little bit rabbit? But when the same researchers talk about using human eggs and human DNA to clone a human being, they won't even call the product of cloning there a little bit human, much less completely human, which is in fact what it is. Odd. You know, just another thing to think about when someone says to you, oh, come on, it's not really human cloning unless we implant it someplace. Well, what is it then? What are you cloning? It's certainly not just a mass of cells. Now, a lot of people kind of help themselves sleep at night on this issue by telling themselves that, but they're telling themselves a lie. But it's just math at this point. You need a lot of human eggs to do what the researchers want to do. Not just a few, a lot. More than there are available. More than there ever could be available. Hasn't stopped them from making their big promises with regard to human cloning for biomedical research and human stem cells, has it? They know the mathematical problem. Good to hear someone's talking about it. Here's Steve calling from his car, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's Audio Open Lines. Thanks for joining us, Steve.
You're missing a lovely commute home in the rain.
Really?
Yeah. You know what I find interesting, and Bill's email kind of plays into this, about the Bible verse about the use of condoms, is we say, oh, those Catholics, but are a lot of American evangelicals any different? Don't smoke, don't drink, don't dance, go through the Da Vinci Code, give 10%. They create weeks. We're all a bunch of little Pharisees, and we like creating these little rules that we try to wrap up, we try to find a Thus Says the Lord Bible verse around. And we end up getting ourselves all tied up.
I think you're right there on that point, Steve. There's no doubt about it. It's evangelicals have no place, and thank you for the call, to mock Roman Catholics for stuff like being restrictive with regard to contraception. Most evangelicals don't even think about that, really. They don't. But to mock them for being restrictive on contraception when they're is arbitrarily restrictive if in fact the Roman Church is being arbitrarily restrictive. You know, I've read the stuff that they've written, and they don't come at it primarily from where's the scripture passage to deal with this. They don't. They say this has to do with man's stewardship of life. And this has to do with saying no to anything that would impede procreation. You know, philosophically, one might even say theologically, their argument is very strong. But we still have to ask the scripture question. They say, look, what happens when a man and a woman come together is not reproduction. I'm just walking you through kind of the current Roman Catholic thinking on procreation and contraception. And a lot of non-Roman Catholics share this thinking. What happens when a man and a woman come together is not reproduction. It's procreation. And the term means everything. We are participants with God in the ongoing sustenance of his creation. when we have babies. And as participants, they would say, we are not permitted to make the decisions because this is really God working through us. So we let God work. That is their philosophical slash theological approach to the whole issue, very consistently. Now, a lot of people confuse Roman Catholic opposition to abortion with Roman Catholic opposition to contraception. They're not the same thing. Roman Catholics are not primarily concerned about contraception because it could be abortion. They're primarily concerned about it because they understand, rightly understand, that the sexual act goes with procreation and should never be divorced from it. It's intended to go together. And they rightly understand that it's not reproduction, it's procreation. Now, when you ask them for a Bible passage, they don't really feel the need to come up with one. It's one of the kind of slippery advantages of being Roman Catholic. But for the rest of us who do want to have a clear thus saith the Lord on an issue like this, if we're going to prohibit it or bind consciences, where's the Bible passage? Anne's calling from Crestwood. Hi, Anne. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. I was Catholic for 40 years, and what I remember them teaching was something about a verse from the Old Testament, I think, that talked about a man who was spilling his seed on the ground, and I don't remember at all where that was. And I'm not Catholic anymore, and it seems I've gone from being a bad Catholic for using any kind of birth control to a Lutheran, where now I'm just a poor, miserable sinner.
Okay.
Flat out across the board.
All right, Anne, thank you very much. So you have so much more to be guilty, to feel guilty for and to realize your guilt for now that it's not just contraception that you're running foul of the church on. Yeah, I understand exactly what you're saying there. The sin of Onan is what this is referred to as, which, and here, you know, those who read the Bible differ whether or not this is a story intended to prohibit contraception or one that shows God's judgment on a man who refuses to do his duty by a woman that should have been his wife, a widow who should have been his wife. And Christians honestly disagree on how to interpret that passage. There's no doubt about what the passage is saying happened. The question is, what does it mean? Now, for the life of me, I can't come up with a Bible passage, a specific Bible passage that prohibits contraception. Let's make it very clear. If contraception is just another term for abortion, then we can come up with the Bible passage. More than one. If we're talking about the taking of a life rather than simply preventing conception, the Bible's very clear on this one. Whether that life is in the womb or outside of the womb, it's very clear. I'm honestly undecided on this one. Honestly undecided on this one. And apart from, now, can Christians disagree? Can Christians follow their conscience in this matter and say, it is contrary to my conscience to do this? Or, I can do this with a clear conscience and an informed conscience. Can they disagree there? Yes, they can. Can they disagree on the interpretation of the story of Onan? Yes, they can. Apart from a clear passage of Scripture, I'm not talking about a passage that says, don't use condoms. You're not going to find that. But a passage that speaks clearly to the issue of contraception. We have to let that disagreement stand. Now, I'm willing to be corrected on this, and I'll probably get emails from people who are willing. I wonder why they're not calling. That's the odd thing. Because I will get emails from them afterwards saying, I can't believe Wilkin wouldn't come down on this issue one way or the other. Well, where's the Bible passage, folks? You know, it's not a popular question to ask nowadays, give me a Bible passage. Because it shouldn't be. We shouldn't be afraid to say, where's your Bible passage? Where's your thus saith the Lord? But for some reason we are. If Scripture doesn't say yes or no, then Christians must be guided by their better sense, their conscience. And Paul even admits that there are places in the spheres in our life, even serious issues, where for one man it is a sin and for another it isn't. That doesn't mean that there's no right or wrong. What it means is there's no clear word from God. All right, let's conclude audio open lines here on a lighthearted note. This one is just a little bit funny, and you're kind of happy for this guy, too. He's kind of a kook, but you're kind of happy because he did a good thing. It's from CBS News, and it's titled, Jesus Nabs Alleged Crook. Listen to this.
I just go around walking like this.
Joe Gaston walks the walk of a true believer.
Doesn't really get heavy on me or anything.
All year long, he rolls around a big cross. This Easter, he assembled a bigger cross and raised it 14 feet into the heavens.
I stay up there for basically 2 days, that Good Friday and that Saturday.
One of his fellow churchgoers gave us this videotape. That's Joe Gaston hanging on his cross. But it's this videotape that's raised him into the spotlight. That's Joe Gaston, the guy who plays Jesus, walking in on a smash-and-grab robbery and wrestling with the robber.
I didn't look to see if he had a weapon or not. I just went to help, and it ended up that he did have a weapon, but no one managed to get hurt, and he got away.
Police say the same suspect has committed at least 5 similar robberies in southeast Houston, sometimes using a gun, sometimes a knife.
You'll see that he's looking over his shoulder and watching people, and I really thought he was getting good enough at it. I think he probably thought he could get away with it and be pretty fast. I think Mr. Gaston shocked him by grabbing him.
The crime buster who honors Christ on the cross figures he owes his life to the Lord for saving him from a knife-wielding robber.
And he was bigger than I am. Who can you give the credit to? Nobody on earth that I know of.
And so Joe Gaston figures he has one more reason
right on my
to
shoulder.
Believe. Duck Miller, 11 News.
Well, I mean, there's a guy. Granted, it is a little odd for someone to sit on top of a 14-foot cross during Good Friday. I think he's trying to remind people of what that day is really all about, dressing up like Jesus, getting up on the cross in his front yard. A little odd, but seems like he did a good thing there for at least for that shop owner who was going to have his goods taken from him. You can't fault him in the bravery department, that's for sure. Just something to kind of lighten your afternoon as you're driving home. When we come back from this break, Wesley Smith is going to be our guest. He's always with us on these issues of life. We were talking just a minute ago about the issue of life at the beginning, be it stem cell or contraception. What about the issue of life at the end? If you go into a hospital, how do you know whether or not the ethics committee that oversees the policies and the practices in that hospital have bought into something like futile care theory or the right to die movement? Wesley is going to answer those questions for us in the last half hour of Issues, Etc. right after this break. You can get in a question or comment for Wesley on this issue. If you're concerned, all of us really should be, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Wesley's written something very interesting called Death by Ethics Committee. We'll talk about the right to die movement with him after this.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What impact do teachings like creation, the fall into sin, the cross of Christ, law and gospel, simultaneously saint and sinner, the Word of God, baptism, and the Lord's Supper have on everyday life? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for May is titled A Theology to Live By, The Practical Luther for the Practicing Christian. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about A Theology to Live By on our website, issuesetc.org. The cost is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. Luther's theology is not abstract speculation, but teaching with a practical application for the real Christian life. A Theology to Live By, Practical Luther for the Practicing Christian, by Herman Preuss. Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for May. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
Refuting compromise. Too many animals on the ark?
Answers with Ken Ham, author of a free booklet on Noah's Ark and Noah's Flood. Ken, I've had Christians tell me that Noah couldn't have possibly put all the types of land animals on his ark. So they say the flood was either not meant to be taken literally or Noah's flood was just a local event. What's your answer to all of this?
Well, in Genesis chapters 6 and 7, it's recorded that God was going to send to Noah, by the way, he didn't have to go out and get them, two of every kind of land-dwelling, air-breathing animal. Now, it's important to note that God said every kind of land animal, not every species or every variety, just the kinds. Now, animals exist in groups we call kinds. For instance, the dog kind, elephant kind, duck kind, and so on. And within the dog kind today, we see many different species, but they're still dogs. This speciation resulted from the dispersion of dogs all across the earth after the flood. But all Noah needed on board the ark were two dogs. So Noah had far fewer animals on the ark than we think, just representative kinds. There was plenty of room on the ark.
Ken Ham answers many more questions about Noah's Ark and a global flood in an intriguing booklet. It's free when you go to our website, AnswersRadio.com. You'll be built up and equipped in your faith when you go to AnswersRadio.com. You'll see all sorts of booklets there on dinosaurs, the origin of races, and many other topics. They're free at AnswersRadio.com.
Historical theology is not just a bunch of names and dates and fact. It's the study of Christ being faithful to his promises.
Dr. Larry Rast of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the importance of historical theology.
Historical theology is the study of theology over the course of time, just like the title says, theology over the course of time. But that can lead some to think that this is a dry, kind of an abstract endeavor. When in fact, what we're talking about with historical theology is the faithful confession ongoing through the church by people that Christ has called, seeing him fulfill the promise that he will never leave the church orphaned or forsaken.
For more information about Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit their website, www.ctsfw.edu.
2 Timothy chapter 3 begins, "But mark this, there will be terrible times in the last days." Do you think that we are in the last days now, or that's a period sometime in the future? Let's talk about 2 Timothy chapter 3 next time on the Bible Study with Pastor Robert Baker of Concordia Publishing House. The Bible Study, weekday mornings, 10:05. The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here in the last half hour, Wesley Smith is our guest. We're going to talk about the Right to Die movement. Now, you think about this as advocacy groups out in Oregon on the West Coast, things like that. Used to be the Hemlock Society and then renamed themselves. They talk about death with dignity. You think about those groups sitting someplace in an office building, you know, with maybe a logo and a phone number and a website and a few employees. But the Right to Die movement has also found its way into the policymakers and the planners for hospitals, too. We're going to talk about the ethics committees and how the Right to Die movement finds itself there as well. Wesley Smith is our guest. He's a regular guest. He's a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute. He serves as an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, and he's author of a recent article for National Review titled Death by Ethics Committee and another for the Weekly Standard titled We Never Say No, Right to Die Movement's Abandoned Pretense. Wesley, welcome back.
Hey, Todd, good to speak with you again.
I'm interested in the title and the content of that Weekly Standard article to begin with, and that is, what shift has recently taken place, an abandonment of pretense, as you say, in the Right to Die movement?
Well, it's not really a shift. It's just that perhaps some people are being a little more vocal in what they're really after. The so-called Right to Die movement or assisted suicide movement often likes to try to sell itself as being merely, and I put that in quotes, about assisted suicide for the terminally ill when nothing else can be done to alleviate suffering, even though legal proposals do not require that nothing else be done to alleviate suffering. In fact, many, not all, but many supporters of assisted suicide have a far broader and deeper death agenda than that planned, and they use the terminal illness issue merely as the foot in the door, if you will, to get people used to the concept of killing as an acceptable answer to human suffering. The issue that had me basically write about this was an announcement out of Switzerland where they have an assisted suicide group called Dignitas, where the head of that basically said he wanted to open up a chain of suicide clinics, almost like it would be a Starbucks for suicide. And then the article goes on to explore that it isn't just this kind, this one organization, but I go into the psychologists and psychiatrists who are proposing something called rational suicide. I talk about the humanists who see a suicide as a right of liberty that is interfered with by laws that prevent assisted suicide and so forth. So there's really a very broad and deep group of various interests that really are beginning to be pro-suicide as opposed to anti-suicide.
You must respond to this. It's a quote, and I pull it straight from that Weekly Standard story you wrote, We Never Say No Right to Die Movement Abandons Pretense. It comes from an Australian physician, Philip Nitsky, and you quote him, your response to this. My personal position is that if we believe there's a right to life, then we must accept that people have a right to dispose of that life whenever they want. Does it follow from a right to life that there should also be a right to death?
No, of course not. But this is the Dr. Nitsky is one of the more outspoken and we might even say candid members of the euthanasia movement. He's even suggested suicide pills for troubled teenagers. And he has this radical individualistic view that since we own our bodies and we have a right to life, that is, obviously, we can't have it taken away from us without due process of law. That's in the Constitution, and we all agree with that. That necessarily implies that we then have a right to take our own lives. Well, everybody has the power to commit suicide, or just about everybody. I mean, that's not an issue of right, but it's an ability. I mean, if I wanted to be dead, Todd, I could be dead within 5 minutes, and so could you. The issue is whether in assisted suicide and euthanasia how do we respond to one of our brothers and sisters who is in such despair that they want to kill themselves? Should we facilitate that? Should we permit that, as the rational suicide types call for? Or should we seek to prevent that? And it seems to me if we really love each other and we really care and have true compassion, which means to suffer with in its root meaning, then we will engage in suicide prevention and finding out what it is. For example, hospice, part of what they do if a terminally ill patient is suicidal is try to find out what it is that is causing that suicide desire and work on overcoming that. And usually, when that occurs, even terminally ill people who are suicidal change their minds. And in fact, when I was trained as a hospice volunteer, I was told very clearly that if somebody appeared suicidal, I was to tell the hospice team so they could take action so that the dying person would not want to commit suicide. The second issue is whether or not we should permit a joint enterprise in the killing of an individual. If I were in such despair that I wanted to kill myself, I could, as I said, within 5 minutes be dead, or if I wanted to be really dramatic, I'm about 40 minutes from the Golden Gate Bridge with traffic, I could get to the Golden Gate Bridge and take a plunge. But should I be assisted, if I'm suicidal, should I have a doctor or someone else be able to do it for me or do it with me? Clearly not, it seems to me. Private killing, that's what we're talking about, accessing and legalizing private killing for certain people. And think about what message would be sent to sick and suffering and despairing people if the state gave its state a seal of approval to some suicides. I mean, if somebody is suicidal and they're in that kind of despair, they're not going to be saying, oh, well, that applies to the cancer patient or that applies to the person who's been in an auto accident and now is paraplegic. It doesn't apply to me because my husband died. That's not how people who are suicidal think. They will get the message loudly and clearly that killing is an acceptable answer to suffering. The state has said so. And therefore, why shouldn't they be included in that, quote, beneficence of death? As well as other people.
I got to wonder how would a state, if we're talking about private killing, under the guise of a right to die, how does any state law prevent just a very clever premeditated murder to take place under the guise of, well, look, they were depressed, maybe they have an estate, you know, they're terminally ill.
Well,
the son can walk in and talk mom into her right to die, and he can walk off with the estate, And under any other system of jurisprudence, that would have been murder.
Well, you know, in one of the people who went to Kevorkian was a woman who had complained bitterly, Elizabeth Curran, I believe her name was, who had complained bitterly to Boston police officers that her husband was abusing her. Yet 2 weeks later, he took her to Kevorkian. She died, and he, you know, there was no problem for him at all. Now, I'm not saying, you know, he killed her or anything, but that just shows you the potential. In Oregon, where we're told that everything is under such strict control, once the terminal, the lethal prescription is issued in Oregon, there are no more supposed protections for the patient. So that if somebody has a lethal prescription and let's say they become demented and they don't know what they're taking, it's quite possible somebody could give them pills and they wouldn't be aware of what it was that was being taken. We just don't know. But the issue, I think, isn't just that murders could be covered up. It's that deaths and suicides that could be prevented wouldn't be. It would be a statement by society that killing is an acceptable answer to human suffering and that autonomy is such that if people want to be killed or want to commit suicide, we should facilitate rather than prevent. And that would open the door to a very broad swath, I think, of belief that that this was acceptable. You know, in Oregon, they complain about elder suicide and youth suicide, and they say, why is this happening? And it seems to me they should connect the dots. I mean, it's not just because they've legalized assisted suicide, but they're sending a real mixed message, aren't they, Todd, when they say, well, if you're terminally ill and you have cancer or you have Lou Gehrig's disease, well, of course, you should swallow poison pills if that's what you want, and a doctor should get them for you. But if you're an elderly person who has 10 years to live but is lonely and or living in a nursing home, you can't kill yourself. What kind of nonsense is that?
So if there are some who are very upfront about their goals and their thinking when they talk about a right to die,
right?
By and large, the assisted suicide movement, such as it is, Is it equally forthcoming about its thinking, its rationale, and what its goals are?
Well, the movement itself is split, I think. There are some who take a very tactical and strategic approach. Among these, I would include what used to be called the Hemlock Society and is now goes by the gooey euphemistic name Compassion and Choices. The head of that is a woman named Barbara Coombs Lee. And she calls, she advocates what she calls a medical model for assisted suicide. And she really works to say this is only this limited right for terminally ill. And she even says it's not suicide because these people don't want to die, but they don't have a life anymore, so it's not suicide, which is basically a way of saying they don't have a life worth living or worth protecting. Then there's there's another strain of the euthanasia movement, epitomized, let's say, by Derek Humphrey, who is the original founder of the Hemlock Society, who sees, he doesn't see any reason to limit it to terminally ill people. Nitsky is a hero who we talked about earlier who was created under the, paid by the Hemlock Society years ago, not the current version, but the older version. They paid Philip Nitsky tens of thousands of dollars to try to develop what was the peaceful pill, that is the suicide pill that should be available in supermarkets, according to Nitsky. So you have this divide. Now, I do think that some of the people who say they only want it for the terminally ill don't really mean it. And I think a few of them, or some of them, maybe more than a few, mean it and naively believe they will be able to limit the killing to that small category. But considering what's happened in the Netherlands and in Belgium, that's just naive at best.
Okay, Wesley, take us to St. Luke's Hospital in Houston, Texas, and tell us, who is Andrea Clark? What is feudal care theory, and how has she found herself on the wrong end of that particular theory?
Well, Andrea Clark was a woman, she just recently died, was a woman who had a very serious illness. She had congestive heart failure, and she had bleeding on the brain. She was not unconscious. She was not, as far as we know, in the state, even as in a state as debilitated as, say, Terry Schiavo, but she was very sick. She wanted her life to be sustained. She was on life-sustaining treatment. She wanted the respirator that she was receiving. Her family wanted her to have the respirator, but a doctor who was treating Andrea Clark decided that he didn't think that her life should be continued through wanted life-sustaining treatment because he thought she was suffering too much or he didn't think her life was worth living. But this, that's not a medical judgment. That's a value judgment. Unfortunately, in Texas, there's a statute that permits ethics committees to decide at the request of doctors to refuse wanted life-sustaining treatment. And at that point, once the ethics committee does that, a patient has 10 days within which to find another hospital to provide the care. Now, Todd, realize that what we're talking about here is care that is not being terminated because it doesn't work, but because it does work. It's not as if it's not what is called physiological futile in Andrew Clark's case. For example, Todd, if I came to you with an earache and I said, take out my appendix, if you were my doctor, you'd say, of course not, because taking out your appendix would be futile in the true meaning of the word. That is, it would not do anything for your ear. In the Andrea Clark case, the respirator was going to be taken off not because it wasn't working, but because it was. So in a sense, it was Andrea Clark's life that was deemed futile or inappropriate. Now, what happened was this imposition, and it's not the first one that's happened in Texas, was imposed, but the family got very public about this, and there was something of a minor hue and cry. It should have been bigger, but there was a minor hue and cry, and pressure was put on Texas, on St. Luke's. At one point, St. Luke's found a hospital for Andrea Clark to be transferred to in Illinois, Todd, 1,000 miles away, and they told the family, at the St. Luke's lawyers told the family on Thursday, if you accept it on Wednesday, if you accept it on Thursday, we'll pay the entire transportation cost, $15,000, although the law doesn't require them to. On Friday, they told the family, if you accept the transfer, we'll pay half the transportation costs. And on Saturday, if you accept it, we'll pay none of the transportation costs. Well, that created a hue and cry. The Illinois facility was found not to be actually capable of caring for Andrea. And there was a pressure put on St. Luke's, and eventually another doctor came in and took over care and said, I don't believe her care is futile. And even though the law permits St. Luke's to say no when a new doctor comes in, I think because of the public pressure, they relented, and they permitted care to continue, and she died just a couple of days ago.
Okay, so the distinction here is, in Andrea Clark's case, is not whether or not the care itself was futile, that is, of no benefit, no medical
right.
benefit to her, because what they were doing to sustain her life was sustaining
exactly
her life.
Exactly correct.
The question was a value judgment of Andrea Clark herself, whether or not her life was an effort in futility.
That's correct, or whether or not, you know, the sometimes doctors and nurses say, well, look, you know, this is not a good decision. This woman's suffering. The time has come to let her go. And, you know, that might be the better judgment, but that's not a judgment. That's a medical judgment. You know, we've been told in the Terry Schiavo case, for example, oh, we must leave this to family. You know, and now it's as if in the Andrea Clark case and medical futility, which, by the way, is involved in many hospitals around the country, it's as if Michael Schiavo and the Schindlers, her parents, agreed to provide Terry's tube feeding, but the doctor said no. That's the kind of thing we're talking about here. And I predict to you, Todd, within the next 5 years, that is going to be the hot issue in bioethics, because for the last several years, this agenda is being set up. These ethics committee protocols are being put in place. And I think you're going to, unless there's a real public outcry, I think you're going to begin to see more and more Andrea Clarks, and also applied against people who aren't as sick as Andrea Clark was.
10 more minutes with Wesley Smith as we talk about the Right to Die movement in all of its aspects. He's a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, author of a recent article for National Review titled Death by Ethics Committee. That's what we're talking about right now. And another for the Weekly Standard titled We Never Say No, the Right to Die Movement Abandons Pretense. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Let's go to the phones. Herman is waiting in Illinois. Herman, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you for taking my call. I would like to ask Mr. Smith this. I'm very curious. A few years back, it started noticing that there were these this privacy law went into effect that said essentially that the medical staff can't tell anyone anything about a patient unless they've signed a waiver or a special form.
Right, that's the HIPAA law, right.
And is that a good thing, or is that just a way to cover up veiled euthanasia activities?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think it can be a very good thing in the sense that part of the reason why that law was passed is because everything is getting computerized. It would be very easy for people's private information to be disseminated. I'm a lay chaplain at a local hospital, and I got a lot of HIPAA training in the sense that the real impetus of my training was to protect patient privacy. However, I do think that an unintended, I don't think this was intended, but I do think that a potential unintended consequence is precisely what you have just described. Because, for example, in some of these food and fluids cases we've had, there's been this supposed clamping down to protect the privacy of the patient, yet sometimes that privacy excuse actually masked false statements that were being put out by the hospital, or let's say misleading statements. An example is the Robert Wendland case here in California, where the hospital was saying that this man who the wife wanted to take away food and water was as good as in a coma, and then some of us got hold of a tape that somehow got leaked to the news media of him fully conscious, taking pegs out of a pegboard on request and putting it back in and so forth. So I think this HIPAA law and privacy is sometimes used as a club, but I don't think that was its intent.
Is it it's still a law worth keeping on the books?
Yeah, it is a law worth keeping on the books, and I support privacy. On the other hand, in some of these public controversies, I think it is important that people be able to get an accurate depiction of what a patient's actual condition really is. I mean, look at the Holly Putra case in Massachusetts. Where within 1 week, doctors were saying this little girl should have her respirator and feeding tube taken out because she was in a persistent vegetative state, which can't be determined in 1 week. And it went to the Supreme Court of Massachusetts that authorized this removal, and it wasn't until the very end when it was found out that she was conscious that the dehydration was suspended and now she's receiving rehabilitation. So, I mean, I do think that we want privacy. On the other hand, you know, we have to protect, and maybe this is something ombudsmen need to be more aggressive with, protecting these very vulnerable patients.
Wessel, you know as well as our audience here that I'm all in favor of bringing attention to bear upon these cases. But for every high-profile case that we
right.
have of this, there must be many cases that are never noticed by the media, do not come to your attention so that you can't bring your considerable talents and skills and voice to bear on it. Don't come to our attention. And I'm wondering, is there, in the Right to Die movement, kind of an underground, a whole series of events underground outside the attention of the media that are happening every day and are as important to shaping the future of what happens in hospitals than Terry Schiavo or the high-profile cases we all know about.
That's interesting. First off, we do know, because, you know, it's not hidden, that as long as family agree, cognitively disabled people are dehydrated to death in all 50 states, not only people who are diagnosed as unconscious, but people who are definitely conscious. That is, families or doctors decide, you know, this isn't a life worth living, and families are often persuaded, and sometimes they decide on their own that it is better that the patient die, and therefore, even though the patient might not be terminally ill, the tube feeding is taken away, which is deemed ethical and legal because tube feeding has been defined as medical treatment. So that is something that is happening, and you know, people can decide for themselves whether they think that's right or proper. I personally don't. And secondly, there is an underground assisted suicide movement among a lot of the Hemlock Society types. Hemlock Society used to have something called Caring Friends that many of us suspected of assisting suicides, and in fact, in their own propaganda, they all but admitted doing that. Whether Compassion and Choice is the new iteration of the Hemlock Society still will carry on that kind of activity, I don't know.
So how is it a simple matter of changing a law or two here and there, Wesley, to say, okay, then let's get hydration and feeding redefined, not as extreme medical care, but as basic necessity? Is it simply a matter of changing a few rules or laws like that with the minute?
Well, you know, I think what it really is about the culture and about whether or not we're going to value these vulnerable people as equal members of society. I would, my biggest fear is this idea of medical futility, that is, where feeding tubes will be taken away from patients in diagnosed in persistent vegetative state because the doctors or ethics committees don't think they have a life worth living as opposed to the families. That is something that I think is of most urgent concern. Secondly, I personally favor that we not consider taking away food and water from somebody unless they've asked that occur in a written advance directive. After the Terry Schiavo case, now we all know that this can happen, and I think it's the responsibility of each and every one of us to decide whether we want that kind of support if we're in certain conditions and let that be known in writing. And absent writing, it seems to me that the default position should be to take the benefit of the doubt on the side of life rather than death.
Wesley Smith is Senior Fellow for the Discovery Institute. He's an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. He's author of two articles, one for National Review recently titled Death by Ethics Committee, another for the Weekly Standard titled We Never Say No, Right to Die, The Right to Die Movement Abandons Pretense. You can find great resources, by the way, on bioethical issues at Wesley's website. It's www.wesleyjsmith.com. www.wesleyjsmith.com. Wesley, thanks for being our guest.
Always good talking to you, Todd.
And to you as well. You know, this is the thing I kept thinking I always do whenever we talk to Wesley about assisted suicide. You only get to do it once. If it's a mistake, lay aside the question of whether it's wrong. And this is something that the state ought to consider when they pass laws that permit such things. There's no turning back from that. You only get to try it once and be successful at it once, and then there's no going back. It seems ill-advised for any state to say, look, let's permit something under the guise of medical treatment and compassion and care that results in someone being dead on purpose, even if it is their will. Tomorrow on Issues, Etc., justification and sanctification. We'll distinguish between the two and try not to confuse them as they are so often today. Dr. Corey Moss of Concordia University in Irvine, California, and we'll talk with Dr. Beverly Yonke on suicide tomorrow on Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. Concordia Publishing House and Issues, Etc. are pleased to offer A Theology to Live By as our Book of the Month for May. What impact do teachings like law and gospel and the means of grace have upon everyday life? Find out with A Theology to Live By. For more information, check out our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. It's the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for May, A Theology to Live By.
Turn on most other radio stations that are religious. Look at the sermons on television. We hardly ever hear the gospel. The true gospel, that we are declared righteous while we're still sinners, before any improvement has begun, God declares us as saints. I want to say that again, because that's what the gospel is, that through faith in Jesus Christ, an individual is declared a saint.
Law and Gospel with Tom Baker, weekday evenings at 6:05 on AM 850 KFUO.